The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So I'll introduce myself for those who don't know me. So my name is Jean Haley. Mark is on retreat. I teach here a little bit. I'm a friend, a partner, a mother, a daughter. Oh, I'm going to tear up when I say this. And most importantly, I'm just a human being. Not just, I am a human being. And trying to figure it all out like you. So these practices and these teachings have helped me a lot to do that. I've been practicing in various traditions since 1998 or so. And I love them all. So I'm very much a student, like all of you. I teach a little bit at the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota. And I teach mindful self-compassion with my friend and colleague, Jane Brownhorse. And I'm happy to be here with you today. So I'm going to offer some reflections on practicing peace. And after I decided I was going to speak on that, it was like, what do I really know about this? Because we're taught only to speak from our own experience. And I have just a little experience of peace, sometimes more than others. But I have a lot of experience with the suffering that's caused when I don't experience peace. So I guess that's my credentials. and I brought along some of my supporters. I always like to have my supporters here. So this is Martin Luther King with Thich Nhat Hanh. Isn't this amazing photograph? So as you may know, Martin Luther King nominated Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm guessing that maybe that photograph has something to do with that, but maybe not. Look how young. Look how young. So as we know, of course, Martin Luther King died very young. Thich Nhat Hanh, I believe, is still alive. He had a very serious stroke. He's in his 80s. I wish Martin Luther King were, but... So I'm going to read something from Martin Luther King in a moment. Because they are the true experts on peace. So a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to take a train to Washington, D.C. Actually, my train was on the same tracks as the one going south with all those Republicans. And we got stopped in White Sulphur Springs, Virginia, when their train derailed. And then we had to take a bus around, and we saw them all coming down in the motorcade. That was interesting. So when we finally got to Washington, we went to the Ford Theater one night. Never been to the Ford Theater where Lincoln was assassinated. And in the basement of the Ford Theater is a museum that commemorates Lincoln's presidency and his life. And one of the exhibits was about Lincoln's cabinet. And maybe you know this, but in Lincoln's cabinet were many of the people that you would identify as his enemies. So he appointed someone named Edwin Stanton to be a Secretary of War. And Edwin Stanton hated Lincoln. And so there was an exhibit on that, and when I saw that, I was reminded that someone, actually the week before, I went to a little conference on nonviolence at Plymouth Congregational Church. Was anybody there? Great conference. And one of the workshop presenters actually read a sermon by Martin Luther King in which he talked about Edwin Stanton and Lincoln. So I want to read an excerpt from that. So this was in a sermon by Martin Luther King entitled Loving Your Enemies, which was delivered in March 1961. Lincoln tried love and left for all history a magnificent drama of reconciliation. When he was campaigning for the presidency, one of his arch enemies was a man named Stanton. For some reason, Stanton hated Lincoln. He used every ounce of his energy to degrade him in the eyes of the public. So deep-rooted was Stanton's hate for Lincoln that he uttered unkind words about his physical appearance and sought to embarrass him at every point with the bitterest diatribes. But in spite of this, Lincoln was elected President of the United States. Then came the period when he had to select his cabinet, which would consist of the persons who would be his most intimate associates in implementing his program. He started choosing men here and there for the various secretaryships. The day finally came for Lincoln to select a man to fill the all-important post of Secretary of War. Can you imagine whom Lincoln chose to fill this post? None other than the man named Stanton. There was an immediate uproar in the inner circle when the news began to spread. Advisor after advisor was heard saying, "Mr. President, you are making a mistake. Do you know this man, Stanton? Are you familiar with all of the ugly things he said about you? He is your enemy. He will seek to sabotage your program. Have you thought this through, Mr. President?" Mr. Lincoln's answer was terse and to the point. "Yes, I know Mr. Stanton. I am aware of all the terrible things he has said about me. But after looking over the nation, I have found he is the best man for the job." So Stanton became Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of War and rendered an invaluable service to his nation and his president. Not many years later, Lincoln was assassinated. Many laudable things were said about him. Even today, millions of people still adore him as the greatest of all Americans. H.G. Wells selected him as one of the six great men of history. But of all the great statements made about Abraham Lincoln, the words of Stanton remain among the greatest. Standing near the dead body of the man he once hated, Stanton referred to him as one of the greatest men that ever lived and said, quote, "He now belongs to the ages," unquote. If Lincoln had hated Stanton, both men would have gone to their graves as bitter enemies. But through the power of love, Lincoln transformed an enemy into a friend. It was this same attitude that made it possible for Lincoln to speak a kind word about the South during the Civil War, when feeling was most bitter. Asked by a shocked bystander how he could do this, Lincoln said, "Madam, do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" This is the power of redemptive love. This is from a collection of Martin Luther King's sermons called The Strength to Love, published in Minneapolis, by the way. So I am very grateful to Lincoln, and I'm grateful to Martin Luther King Jr., and I'm grateful to Edwin Stanton for showing that it's possible. It's possible to move beyond political differences to see the value, the fundamental value in other human beings, and to practice what King calls redemptive love. And I am also grateful to the Buddha for teaching the practices that help us to find this peace, both internally and externally. So I don't know if you're like me, but sometimes I kind of get bogged down by the whole thing being the teachings. It seems very complicated. It's like, can I remember all that stuff? And am I ever going to be a stream enterer? Actually, I don't worry too much about that. But there's a lot. I mean, I don't remember how many volumes there are in the Pali Canon, but does anybody know? It's a lot. And so it's like, wow, this just seems like a lot. But I discovered a few years ago when I had the opportunity to be on a retreat with Gil Fronsdahl. If you know Gil Fronsdahl, he's a great teacher in this tradition, also a Zen practitioner and a scholar. He has a PhD from Stanford in religious studies, something like that. He reads Pali. He knows the teachings very Well, and he wrote this wonderful little book called The Buddha Before Buddhism. And it's actually going to be a book that's read by the Sutta Studies Group, if you're in that. So Gil gave a talk on this little book, which is also called The Book of Eights. And what I like about this, it's 16 poems. And in Gil's opinion anyways, as well, I shouldn't call him Gil, I don't know him personally, Dr. Fronsdahl's opinion is more respectful. This is one of the, if not the earliest teachings of the Buddha. And there's all sorts of evidence that he provides in this little book about why that's so. And it's very simple. And that's one of the reasons that I love it. And it's believed to have been written within years of the Buddha's enlightenment. And these poems were chanted by the followers of the Buddha. So, and in this book, there's no mention of arahants, stream enterers, all these hierarchies that were developed later, evolved later, nor are there any lists. There's not even the Four Noble Truths in this little book. It's just very simple. Simple, but not easy, as they say. So, rather than having people that are esteemed because of their spiritual attainments or their powers of concentration or whatever. In the Book of Eights, the ideal spiritual person is referred to simply as a sage. And this sage is judged on his or her or their character and behavior rather than some sort of transcendent spiritual qualities, which is good news for me. I don't know, maybe it's good news for you. Because I'm, yeah, whatever. So I like it. So this is a quote from what Dr. Fronsdahl says in this book. The most common attribute associated with a sage is peace, santi. He, she, they advocates peace, sees and knows peace, is at peace, and is peaceful. The sage is also tranquil, still and unmoving, unshakable and equanimous. Though peace is clearly an attribute of sages, they do not depend on peace or intentionally take it up. This is because sages do not depend on or take up anything. Instead, they let go. So what an idea. We attain peace not through practicing something in particular, but through the practice of letting go. So this letting go includes not only letting go of sensual pleasures, but equally important, letting go of attachments to views or beliefs, especially attachment to views or beliefs. And that, of course, as you may know, was a big deal to the Buddha, because there were a lot of religious beliefs then, as there are now, that people were very attached to, and he was encouraging people to look at that and perhaps let them go. So letting go of beliefs about which religion is superior, and also beliefs about the worth or lack of worth of people with views different from our own. So for me, that's the difficult part. So I think that this is what Lincoln was practicing, although he wouldn't have framed it this way, when he put aside his feelings and his opinions about Stanton and about the South in the interest of peace. He rose above that. So in the 15th chapter of the Book of Eights, this little book, it's entitled The Discourse on Being Violent. And it's unique in that the Buddha actually describes his experience before he was enlightened, what it was like to live in the society. So he was of the warrior class. You know, there was a lot of war going on. And he talks about what it was like for him as he witnessed that in his society. And this is part of that poem. Violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water, And seeing them feuding with each other, I became afraid. The world is completely without a core. Everywhere things are changing. I don't know about you, but that kind of sums up how I'm feeling these days. The world is without a core. So the rest of the poem talks about what he learned through his process of enlightenment. What was before, let it wither away. What was later, do nothing with it. Not grasping what's in between, you'll live at peace. By not taking as mine anything that is name and appearance, and not grieving what doesn't exist, one is not diminished in this world. Sages do not say that they are inferior, superior, or equal to others. Peaceful, unselfish, they neither embrace nor reject. So when we are busy trying to keep things the same, we're trying to protect what we perceive to be ours, and we compare ourselves to others, it's hard to find peace. At least that's my experience. And for me, this is the really hard work because it requires ourselves to look honestly at all the ways that we set ourselves apart from others. And that's both feeling superior and inferior, as well as the same as, and trying to find the common ground rather than these differences. So how do we do that? So Pema Chodron, in her book entitled When Things Fall Apart, maybe you know that book, it's 20 years old now, she talks about three methods for working with chaos. I think that could be pretty useful these days. And it goes like this. So the first is to practice mindfulness, to slow down, to pay attention, and to let the storylines go. I just spent a week in Mexico. I came back last night. It was incredible. And it was all about slowing down, noticing what's happening, and especially letting all our stories go about what is happening. So just stopping this struggle and just being present, just being present. The second is to take a different attitude towards suffering. So instead of pushing it away, seeing it as a problem, to breathe it in and to breathe it out with the wish that everyone stop hurting. So to use your own suffering as a bridge to others' suffering. And for those of you who know the Tibetan practice of Tonglen, that's what she's talking about. So in Tonglen, you're actually breathing in the suffering of others and you're breathing out what you feel would be helpful. And to finally, just acknowledging that suffering, like joy, is a part of the basic energy of the universe. Right? It's here. The world that we find ourselves in is what we've got to work with. Whether we like it or not, it's what we have to work with. So I've been practicing the second method a lot, using my own suffering and despair about what's going on in the world to connect to others. And I've found Tonglen for me is a kind of a difficult practice. I resist breathing in the suffering of others, so I've fiddled with it a bit. And I practice focusing on my own suffering, my own despair, wishing peace for myself, and then sending that wish out to others who are experiencing similar situations. So people who are experiencing the pain of intolerance, the pain of political discord, the pain of violence, the pain of racism, sexism, you name it. And there are plenty of those people. And when I do that, I feel less isolated and I feel less afraid. And I've also added in a little bit of equanimity practice. This is a work in progress for those whom I really struggle with, to feel more compassionate towards them. So the Dalai Lama teaches that we all want to be happy, and I would translate that to mean that we all want inner peace, just as the Buddha taught in the Book of Eights. It's interesting, he very rarely mentions suffering in the Book of Eights. He mentions peace. And surely we all want that, even those who engender fear in us. We all want inner peace. I think I can say that. So I'd like to invite you to engage in a practice with me, and then maybe if we have time we can talk about your experience with that and any wisdom you might have to throw into the pot. So let's see, when do the kids come?
11:40.
Okay, all right, we will make this quick. So is everybody game? Okay, so if you would find a comfortable posture again. We'll start with the bell. And once again, settling into the body. Feeling the weight of the body sitting. Feeling the breath coming into the body and the breath leaving the body. Inviting the body to relax. And from this place of connection to your breath and to the breath of everyone in this room, bring to mind something you are struggling with, something that causes fear or anger or other difficult emotions to arise. Could be a difficult relationship, financial insecurity, climate change, war, or the pain of racism, sexism, or other forms of oppression. If a whole bunch of them show up in your mind, just choose one. And feel the full weight of it on your sense of well-being. On your body and on your mind. Feel the suffering. And now as you breathe in, offer yourself the wish that your suffering be relieved. Breathing in, silently offer yourself the wish for peace. May I be at peace. May I find ease and well-being. Breathing in the wish for inner peace and well-being. And now bring to mind those whom you imagine might be suffering in a similar way, perhaps not in exactly the same circumstances, but with similar distress. If you're working with fear for the planet, perhaps imagining all the beings affected by climate change, or with an illness, all those who are also experiencing some form of ill health. So holding the felt sense or the actual images of these beings in your heart mind, imagining their suffering. Just like you, they too long for peace. And as you breathe in, continuing to offer yourself the wish for peace, may I be at peace. And as you breathe out, sending out that wish to those who are suffering in similar ways, may you be at peace. May you be at peace. Breathing in for yourself, may I be at peace. Breathing out to the others, may you be at peace. And now bringing to mind a person who is depriving you of happiness, whom you perceive to be depriving you of happiness, of peace. This may be someone with whom you have a personal relationship or someone on the national or international scene. Bringing them to mind now. And if you need a little protection, you might imagine he, she, they standing on the other side of the street or behind a barrier. Whatever allows you to bring them into your heart and your mind. And reflecting that fundamentally this person, like you, this person too wishes to find inner peace and freedom from suffering. Opening your heart as little or as much as you can in this moment. And breathing in for yourself the wishes for peace in the face of suffering you experience in relation to this being. May I be at peace. And breathing out now for this being who also wants peace, may you be at peace. We're all beings just wanting peace. Breathing in for yourself, may I know peace. Breathing out for the other, may you know peace. Keeping it as simple as you can. Noticing any tightening, contraction, resistance, and making space for that as well. Now, including everyone in this room this morning, we all want peace. Breathing in for yourself, may I know peace. Breathing out to everyone in this room, may you all know peace. May we all know peace. And now, before this meditation comes to a close, just resting for a moment without bringing anything or anyone to mind. Settling your awareness on awareness itself. With no object and with no subject. Just awareness. The space of peace. Breathing in and breathing out. I'm going to end with a poem and a quote. This is a poem by someone named Miller Williams entitled Compassion. Have compassion for everyone you meet, even if they don't want it. What appears bad manners in ill temper or cynicism is always a sign of things no ears have heard, no eyes have seen. You do not know what wars are going on down there where the spirit meets the bone. And this is a quote from I don't know whom. I heard it at a nonviolent communication training. Maybe you know who said it. To dethrone a tyrant, you first have to tear down the throne you've built in your own heart. To dethrone a tyrant, you first have to tear down the throne you've built in your own heart. So we have just a few minutes before the children come in, so I'd like to open it up. If anyone has any wisdom on the topic that they'd like to share, any responses to what I said or to the meditation, for the good of the group, I'd love to hear it.
I was reminded that President Obama chose Hillary Clinton for his Secretary of State, and he said that very thing, that we need to make friends with our enemies. And I'm heartened by what you said today and reminded of that there are great people still living in the world, and a lot of them right here.
Thank you. Including you.
Good morning. My name is Menarda. I'm doing a self-mastery training right now with sacred activism, and so this has been on my mind a lot. And in the last couple days, I've been reading about the practices of kind of maintaining resilience as a sacred activist, and the four things that Andrew Harvey talks about in the book, The Hope, are cooling practices like meditation, warming practices to warm the heart like loving kindness, prayer, which has been on my mind a lot as I see so many people downplaying and shaming people that use prayer to get through tragedy, and then body practices like yoga and qigong. So I appreciate this talk today. Thank you.
Hey, my name is Jesse. And I just wanted to say that I kind of see now how it makes sense to make friends with your enemy, because maybe they're suffering. You can see a person who is violent or who is not doing well in ways that you can see it as they're suffering rather than seeing that they need to be fought against or insulted. Is you can be friends with somebody because maybe that's what they need, is to just know that they don't have to be at the mercy of anger and be ate up inside and to be like an awful, violent person. So I kind of saw the point of being friends with your enemy is just kind of like seeing them as suffering.
Thank you for your talk. My name is Jake. I think my own practice around peace lately has been in trying to more quickly and clearly distinguish between wise and unwise action in response to seeing conditions that don't give rise to peace. I think for me a danger that I've come to see in how I relate to peace is sometimes to kind of spiritualize the idea of inaction in a way that prevents me from doing what's necessary. I would be interested in hearing any thoughts you have in response to that.
Well, nonviolence is a form of action, right? I don't know if you're talking about that, but You know, we can choose to not do something because we're afraid or whatever, if we really look at our intention, or we can choose to do something as an act of peace. I don't know if that's my take on it anyway, so I don't know if that gets at what you're talking about. I can't see you. There you are. Is that what you're talking about? You're talking about wise action could be choosing not to do anything, but it's all about, you know, if we look at our intention and then choose a path of action, it could include non-action, but it requires some discernment, I guess, is what I would say. Is that what you're speaking to? Yeah.
I had a discussion with my brother this morning about our president. And I was saying things where I had thrown him out of my heart. And I know this practice, but I don't always do it. But whenever I throw someone, and it can be someone close, it can be someone far away, it can be remote, whenever I throw someone out of my heart, I feel like I'm doing damage to myself. And so I think the greatest gift when I do hear the other and see the other for where they are and recognize that they're all a product of causes and conditions that bring their pain and suffering and their actions, only then can I fully see my own too and then forgive myself and hopefully them as well.
I love what you said about we're all the product of these causes and conditions, most of which we don't know anything about. We create a story about it, and then we respond out of that story. Thank you.
Me again. I talked to our guiding teacher here about my difficulty with the current president and aware that my own peace was being shattered by my inability to include him in loving kindness. And Mark said, all you need to do is to wish him no harm. And that helped. That helped me a great deal because it was a place to begin. It was a place to begin. So rather than kvetch, kvetch, I could come to wishing that no harm come to him and have been able to, and also to stop being critical of myself. I mean, I should be, and actually I knew that I couldn't, so that really helped me.
Mm, thank you. Yeah, I think the self-compassion piece is big. And for me also then to realize that there's so many others who are suffering in the same way under, if you consider this to be a form of oppression.
I'm Ellen, and I don't know what to say about this, but I just want to bring the thoughts of all the women who have been shaken by the Me Too, shaken up, shaken down, shaken in all ways, that the violence is right here in our daily lives, in our relationships. And I thank you so much, Jean, for your words.
Okay, get to say something. This is something I've talked to some of my friends before, and they've heard this, but and I'm not quite sure how it fits in. But I read an opinion piece two or three weeks ago speaking and talking about how President Trump doesn't appear to have any friends and doesn't appear that he's ever had any friends. And that whole thing just really struck me because it brought a whole different dimension. I mean, not judging why or should he not have friends, but to think about living my life, I'm as old as he is, without having a friend, somebody that you can talk to. And that just really gave me a soft spot. You know, I still resist, but no friends. Can't imagine.
I guess I just want to say one other thing. That I hope that this space is safe for everyone, regardless of what your political views are. So there may be people who support the current administration. That's okay. You know, what we're doing is making space for everyone and seeing if we can open our heart to the full range of human experience. So I felt like that needed to be put out there, because it can feel unwelcoming and scary, I would imagine, for people who might have different views. Thank you.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.